Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. You doing all right? Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And like all the shows, all the podcasts here at WFYI, we are available on Spotify. Special show. And a special guest. How special? A guest? Well, one has his own music.
Wait for it. No, really.
It's called Inception.
Yes, Brian Hartz is in studio.
We're up to 18 now. Does it just get longer every time?
No, now that you've mentioned it, maybe. Because if I remember, I think
it's hit critical mass. It just grows on its own now.
Well, your lovely wife's intro, I believe, is longer than yours. And, of course, BB's collaboration with Hans Zimmer is the longest at about 3 minutes.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So thanks for being here. Thanks for braving the world to kind of... So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to bring a little bit of levity, I hope, in lieu of how things are going these days.
Since you can't see me, I'm actually wearing the suit that Marty McFly wears in Back to the Future. I am Darth Vader from the planet Vulcan.
Wow. So, so that's kind of where we're at as we're recording this on Friday. Well,
otherwise known as... Day zero, quarantine.
Something like that. I'm going to tell you, we've already had a number of delays and cancellations. It's interesting that as the time we're recording this, movie theaters are still open. So long as...
Curious.
Yeah, because there's been a number of theatrical productions that have been canceled or delayed or cut short.
Live theater, that is.
Yeah, so I'm curious about that. So... but there is,
I guess, as long as they have fewer than 250 seats in any given theater.
There is that, and of course, I was the insensitive clod that when they said, I think in New York it was at one point it was 500, and I said, well, Knicks games are still okay. So
all right,
and that
there,
yeah,
there you
I'm
go.
That guy.
Well, but then the NBA just dropped everything.
They did. So opening in theaters this weekend, and this is at the I checked. Keystone Arts is still happening, but. The film The Traitor is opening, and this follows a mob boss in Brazil who is arrested, and this is based on a true story because every other thing is based on a true story, of and what happens when he's arrested, extradited back to Italy, and basically turns state witness and winds up taking out, if I remember right, over 360 arrests in organized crime. So... the filmmaker who I'm wanted to make basically a big old action, big old mob epic. I think in the same similar realm as The Godfather or Goodfellas. And there are no new aspects to the mob film that I haven't seen already, except for one thing, and I did not know this, and this was probably the most fascinating, is the courts, in at least in this particular area and this particular film. First off, you have it's wide open. You have other accused that are in cells in the courtroom, and also the fact that the other accused can cross-examine the witness. So you get some lovely moments of two criminals contradicting each other and having a war with words with each other.
Seems like a nightmare for prosecutors if you're trying to go after organized crime.
Something like that. So, and there's some Shakespearean elements. He has some moments. The head who's Bruschetta, not bruschetta. It's a name, not a dish.
He's not tomatoes on toast.
Right. But there's moments of there's some Shakespearean visions of his own funeral and the deaths of his family. So you know, there's little Macbeth in there, and it's okay to say Macbeth on the radio. Hi, Glenn.
As far as we know.
I know.
So, you never know what's going to be a disease vector now.
That's true. That is true. But it's also, yeah, seeing and also what happens when you have a slew of defendants and who's going to turn first, who winds up doing things like there's moments of sewing. One defendant who sews his own mouth shut, another one that disrobes and claims to have gone crazy. So there, if you're in for an old-fashioned mob film, it's a good film. I enjoyed it, and with the exception of what I've just described for you, the courtroom scenes, it's something you haven't seen before, but it's done very well. And the lead performance, and pardon my Italian, it's Pier Francesco Favino, who American audiences have seen in the – wow, how ironic. He appeared in the film World War Z.
As well as
the inspector in Angels and Demons. He was Christopher Columbus in Night at the Museum and was also in – there you go. Immediately you knew that. And in the Ron Howard auto racing film Rush. And it kind of looks like if Tim Curry and Eric Bogosian had a child. A really solid performance from Favino. Doesn't go over the top and it's an underplayed performance. So
like more like early Pacino.
Yes, early Pacino. Early, yeah, not yelly screamy Al Pacino. And I can't remember the actor. There's a wonderful that guy who's being interviewed by Kevin Pollak, and he interviews the different eras of Pacino. So he starts with, you know, Godfather era,
nice.
And then moves into And Justice for All, and then Revolution, and then into Son of a Woman. From here on out.
Yeah, pretty much just.
Yeah.
This one goes to 11.
So yeah, The Traitors in theaters, if you choose to go out, I'm really kind of torn on that because the movies, just like live theater, is a communal event.
Yeah.
I guess,
it's a Keystone Arts, right?
Yeah.
Well,
and
they could use the business and, you know.
There is that as well. It's been interesting the read online. Suggestions that if you're supposed to, for instance, if you're going to see a play, don't necessarily ask for a refund. Consider it a donation to that theater company or to that theater.
Right.
So
absolutely.
Something to think about there.
Yeah. Speaking of, I wonder how the art craft's doing down in Franklin and our other local theaters.
Have you taken the family down there yet?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's been a while, but
okay.
But they were supposed to be showing Aliens this weekend. That was pretty exciting.
Oh, man, that's right. So, yeah, I guess if you decide to go out, take proper precautions and be good to one another.
Don't
out
be
there.
Silly. Wash
yeah.
your hands.
All the other stuff. So
I guess it wouldn't be all bad for them to hand out the wipes with the popcorn or something.
That wouldn't be a bad idea. That would not be a bad idea. So shifting gears just a little bit, I guess I was talking with Brian a little bit yesterday in lieu of getting ready for the show. But you did some really good husband work last night, I heard.
Oh, Monica's, yeah, not been feeling well. Don't worry, folks. Not the coronavirus.
Yes.
Just probably ordinary seasonal flu. Hi, Monica.
Hi, Mon. We'll get you on soon.
Hope you're feeling all right.
But she picked the movie last night.
Yeah, yeah. I actually got to see America's Sweethearts for the first time. So in case you're, you know, like 19 years behind on your rom-coms, like I am, you could do far worse than check out John Cusack and Catherine Zeta-Jones and Julia Roberts in, Sweethearts.
I wish all assistants looked like Julia Roberts circa 2000.
It's somewhat... Drain's belief that she and Catherine Zeta-Jones would be sisters, but whatever. It also features Hank Azaria playing a Spaniard. So, hey, it was 2001, folks.
Yes, it did. And while you were watching that, I was watching The Rose, which I had purchased at a library sale. Thank you. But this was Bette Midler's first film. It's not about Janis Joplin. It's so because, you know, she was known as the Pearl. This is The Rose.
Ah,
but Midler plays
that's a different thing.
Right. She plays a burnt-out rock singer on tour with obligatory English manager played by Alan Bates.
Is that the one from which the eponymous song, The Rose,
yes,
comes?
Yes,
oh, okay.
It is.
Okay. Well, I know Monica is especially fond of that, as is her mother. So
there
you go.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, it's a burnt-out rock singer on the road. She falls in love with a limo driver played by Frederick Forrest, who also received the nomination for supporting
actor. Bobby McGee.
No, not Bobby McGee. And you also see some familiar faces like Barry Primus, a young David Keith, pre-Officer and a Gentleman in this one. Harry Dean Stanton has one nice scene.
Dean Stanton was contractually obligated to appear in every film in the 1970s.
And you know what? That's not bad.
It's not bad at all.
Or he took turns with Rip Torn.
Pretty much, yeah.
Kind of
yeah.
That
you,
sort of
you
thing.
You need a haggard-looking white dude.
You rang?
Just, you know, flip a coin.
but it was Midler's film debut because she received a Best Actress nomination for that, and well deserved. We've seen the burnt out artist story before, probably not as much as we did in 1979. It does have a sort of a Star Is Born vibe to it as far as arena rock, which was still fairly or young in when it came to rock music.
Hadn't hit the peak of the curve yet.
Not quite.
Probably a few years later with some Journey album or
something like that. But yeah, anyway, it was fun to revisit that. I haven't seen that probably in 25 years. And I'm the guy that listens to everything. So Mark Rydell, the director, did a commentary track. So of course I listened to it. So that was what I was watching in lieu of cleansing, because we both cleansed our palate this week. The main reason why I wanted Brian on the show, besides the fact that he's just really good fodder, but we raise a glass to Max von Sydow, the great Swedish actor who passed away earlier this week at the age of 90. And
not a bad run.
Not a bad run at all.
Although there were those of us who thought he would probably just live forever.
Yeah, I mean, so he's in that. He was in that kind of Christopher Lee of category of, man, still going.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we just looked it up. The guy's film career started in 1949, and there was nary a year between then and now that he wasn't working.
Yep.
That's a career, my friends.
And like Lee, in the tail end, probably the last 20 years, even 30 years, he was always good, even though the material wasn't. But he was able to he became one of the cinematic elder statesmen.
Yes,
you know,
he's
showing
probably
up.
Been doing that for 40 years.
I know, because I think the first thing that popped up was that I noticed he started to get those roles was like Awakenings,
mm-hmm.
and then had the great moments in a Minority Report, and
absolutely.
Of course got some Star Wars money, so that's always good.
Yes.
We always like that.
Yeah. If you want just instant gravitas, just throw Max von Sydow on the screen. And,
yeah.
And you know, you've done half the work of your character development already.
And it's interesting that I believe that was Woody Allen had a similar quote of just showing up is one of the keys. But I was looking back through his filmography, and it has been fun. I remember when he died. There was some brushback depending on who wrote the headline, because somebody would just say Star Wars actor or Bergman actor, and somebody got it right when they mentioned the films of Ingmar Bergman and Flash Gordon, and
You take it all.
Right.
That's actually one of the things I appreciate about Fonsito is that, like, without falling into the trap of being like a Ben Kingsley who's appeared in some genuine garbage.
Oh, man, he's had his share.
But Max Fonsito was sort of unfussy about his image and the kinds of projects he did. And there was quite a variety. He was not opposed one bit to genre cheese like Flash Gordon, in which he admirably chewed the scenery.
Oh yeah,
and also showing up in some of the most abstruse art films of all time.
Yeah, and it's funny because my introduction to him. So I'm of an age that I was old enough to see these in the theater, but here were my first I think five films that I saw Max Fonsito in, Flash Gordon. Victory. That was the other one. I'm sorry. Victory, Flash Gordon, Conan the Barbarian.
Oh, yeah.
Which you have a framed poster of in your house, by the
yes.
way. Just mentioning that. Strange Brew and, Never Say Never Again. And then later, and I forgot he was in Dune because I don't want to remember Dune, but about Hannah and her sisters as well. So it wasn't until college that I started watching the Bergman films, but by that time, because if you were a young film nerd in the 70s and 80s like I was, you knew the parodies before you actually watched it. We knew about Playing Chess, and we were fans of Woody Allen, so we saw those homages of Playing Chess with Death, the lady's split screen face from Persona used in Love and Death.
Yes,
I believe it was in Bananas. Where Woody Allen talks to a psychiatrist about a dream he has where he's being carried through the New York streets on a crucifix and goes for a parking spot. And as they're backing in, another group carrying another person on a crucifix takes the parking spot. And everybody who was holding a crucifix gets into a fight. So I knew the parodies before watching the actual
fast motion, like typical early Woody Allen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but not to mention the monks from Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yep.
And, of course, who could forget the timeless homage in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey?
That is true. That is true, yeah. And I didn't see...
talking about, of course, homage to The Seventh Seal. I don't know if we actually specified that that's what we were talking about.
And the other one was, and I remember a moment where the three associates, that would be Lynn and Emma and I, we were the only ones in the theater laughing out loud in the last Muppet film, Muppets Most Wanted. At the beginning of the film, there is a moment where they are doing what the characters have been doing since the last movie, and there is footage. There is a black and white moment on the beach with the Swedish Chef.
Wow.
Yeah. I think that was really strong. It was great. And I'm sure audience members turned around and looked at us. We didn't care. So,
that's kind of how I felt when I saw Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. But I was at home eating pizza with my parents.
It feels good, though.
Yeah.
A little cinematic gratification. Yes. Yeah. I was in high school when I finally watched The Exorcist. And I know that was – so here – I guess going back a little bit, so Brian, I guess what was your first encounter with Max's films?
That's a tough one to nail down because I've seen most of those that you just mentioned, so I'm not sure where exactly I first knew I was watching him, but in one of those handful of films as well, or perhaps also I'm a sucker for the huge old Hollywood epics, so I know that I saw The Greatest Story Ever Told at some point.
Swedish Jesus.
Swedish Jesus. Yes. Yes. Boy, that was a.
Well, there were a number of bloated biblical films made in the 1960s.
Yeah,
John Huston.
While I enjoy the hell out of some of them, that one in particular is a smorgasbord of stunt casting. I mean, Pat Boone is it never crying out loud.
And, of course, everyone's favorite guard, John Wayne.
Yes, yes. Just screams Roman.
And if you – well, yes, yeah, true. Tony Curtis doesn't know what you're talking about. But strangely enough, and ladies and gentlemen, sometimes this is the madness to my method or how the sausage is made here at Film Sociology. I found at another library sale a Blu-ray of Nicholas Ray's King of Kings, speaking of biblical films.
In which Jeffrey Hunter.
Jeffrey Hunter, also known snarkily as I Was a Teenage Jesus. But he was in his thirties, I believe, when he made that film. Yes. But
also,
you know,
known to us nerds as the original Captain Pike from Star Trek.
That's right.
And so the original Captain of the Enterprise was Jesus.
So take that.
Make of that what you will.
But
I don't know how we got there, but
just biblical stuff. We'll get to that. But yeah, I think most biblical films are just too long. Granted, it's a lot of material to cover,
most of them skip the Begats at least.
But yeah, Hunter, Blue Eye Jesus, and this one, and I found out after while watching it that they had to have reshoots of the crucifixion because Mr. Hunter had a little bit of chest hair, and some folks thought that would be a distraction. So they had to reshoot the crucifixion.
Okay.
So anyway, but yeah, Swedish Jesus, and that was Von Sydow's first, if I remember, his first American film, because then. He worked on 11 films with Bergman, and we'll get to the Bergman stuff in a moment. But yeah, that and then the other the 1966 bloated epic Hawaii with Julie Andrews, starting the score. Yeah, worked with John Huston.
That was one of those James Michener adaptations, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Okay. The Kremlin Letter, which there was an interview I saw with Von Sydow on the Criterion, one of the Criterion discs. That talked about, yeah, people assumed he was German because of the Von in his name, so he got a lot of those roles.
Yeah. Well, actually, I read an interview because I wanted to know exactly how to pronounce his name because there's a million variations.
Yes.
And it is, in fact, Von Sydow. But he said that it was confusing even for Swedes because it is, in fact, a German name,
right.
German extraction. The reason I looked it up was because on Monday when he died, I heard some overzealous BBC announcer try to pronounce it something like Von Sydow or something.
Wow.
Which, who knows? That might be a legit Swedish pronunciation. Couldn't tell you.
If you're Swedish, please tell us. And, tell us. No, don't just tell us you're Swedish. Tell us if we're correct. So, I'm Swedish. Thank you.
If you're a chef, also a chef.
Wow. 1973, of course, played Father Marin in The Exorcist, only in his 40s. So
true.
Nice.
And so,
yeah.
When you finally got around to seeing The Exorcist, did it live up to the hype for you?
It did. I was in high school, and my God. But the great moment, and this is one of the early moments where I started to become crusty old cinema guy, was I talked a bunch of friends into watching The Exorcist in college. And 10 minutes in, they're bored because they had been programmed because of the slasher films of the 70s to, they expect a body count with the start within 5 mm-hmm. to 10 minutes of the film. And, truth be told, spoiler alert on an almost 50-year-old film, but, the real scary stuff doesn't kick in until about 45 minutes into the picture.
Right.
But when it does, it delivers. So, yeah, I think it did for me. What about you?
I think it might be one of those cases where a film is a victim of its own success, in that there have been so many imitators, and by the time I got around to seeing it, I'd seen so many clips from it as well that I was like, oh, so this is how it all fits together. And the Captain Howdy stuff was like, oh, well, okay, I get it. That's a scary face. All right.
Uh-huh.
I mean, beautifully made, really, wonderful atmospheric performance, and obviously, Von Sydow is pretty terrific, and then there's Linda Blair.
Yep.
It was one of those. I'll probably have to revisit it at some point because I was expecting the scare of your life that was advertised.
And in 1973, it proved to be that because.
Usually I can sort of, if I'm watching something of a certain era or even something really famous, I can do enough reframing of my own point of view to sort of put aside everything else I know and try to see it as it would have been seen at the time. But
you're at least not my daughter, who when I showed her Jaws, her response was, "It's all right. I could see how that would have scared you when you were 5." The little hipster. Hi, Emma. But yeah, also she was at that time she was willing to watch that and The Exorcist, but in the daytime. I'll watch it in the daytime.
Ah,
yeah,
all right.
So
tough under the red circumstances.
Right. Text from her saying, "Shut up, Dad!" In 3, 2, you'll get those 2, 2, 1.
Fair enough. Once BB had learns how to text.
So yeah, Father Marin and The Exorcist, 3 Days of the Condor, which I need to revisit. Now I'm hoping. I remember watching this. I worked at a crummy video store in the Chicago suburbs back in the 90s, and I came across a VHS copy of this. I don't think it's gotten a proper release on DVD. A film called The Ultimate Warrior. No, not The Wrestler. It is a film. The title role is played. It's a fighting, killing machine played by Yul Brynner. And also features Max, and it's directed by Robert Klaus, the man who gave us Enter the Dragon, and also Jim Cotta. So it's kind of in between those. Also did Black Belt Jones. So I'm hoping Warner Brothers will finally put this out. Even if you put it out in the archive movie series, I would buy this. Because okay. I just remember, wow, these two probably got paid well. And, Yul Brynner didn't have to emote.
This was post-Westworld Yul Brynner, so...
Yeah, 72 years after,
all
so...
All he had to do was show up and scowl
kinda,
and collect a paycheck.
And he got that with The Ultimate Warrior, so I'm hoping that will get more open, I guess.
You know Warner's has it, because they've got it.
They have it, yeah. So, hey, Warner's, put it out, please.
Get on that, will you?
Yeah, Voyage of the Damned, which I actually watched earlier this year, where he's the captain of a ship of Jews fleeing Europe. And what happens, they go to New York and they have to be sent back to Europe. So this was one of those films that Roger Ebert always says, be aware when you have – it's a warning when the film has a poster with the little faces of the cast at the bottom of the poster, the all-star international cast, meaning they got paid well to do not a whole lot and in a short amount of time. So there is that, March or Die, Hurricane. That's another of the forgotten bad disaster movies, which I believe was shot in Bora Bora. I saw Flash Gordon in the theater with my dad. And one of the gentleman who does the commentary tracks for the Bergman films, who's just a Bergman-esque scholar, and talked about met Max on the set of Flash Gordon.
Wow.
and was wondering, why are you doing this? And apparently Max went for several minutes talking about his character. So he was actually committed.
Invested.
Yeah, he was invested.
I
so there's
it.
There's something to be said about that.
I believe it.
And he's the best thing about Flash Gordon because Flash Gordon is not a quarterback for the New York Jets, and there you have Topol, and you have a young Timothy Dalton, and you have music by Queen, and it's
Brian freaking Blessed.
Brian Blessed is probably a very close second best thing
that
about
that movie is basically a scenery chewing competition, and every minute is worth it.
And I think Max uses a knife and a fork. Brian uses his bare hands. I came up with that, and I don't know if anybody's come up with that, but Isabelle Huppert chewed scenery with a knife and fork in a film last year. So,
nice.
That's probably – and Mike Hodges directed this. This is the man who gave us Get Carter, and it's
– Well, it's a lovely chain of ironies that tracks both this film and Von Sydow and Star Wars, because, of course, one of the origins of Star Wars was Flash Gordon, but George Lucas didn't have the money to get the rights to Flash Gordon in the 70s, so he made Star Wars, and in the wake of everybody wanting to do another Star Wars, Flash Gordon was made. Fast forward another 40 years, and Von Sydow finally showed up in Star Wars.
Yes, about time, yeah.
For a minute and a half of screen time, but again, instant gravitas. Don't have to develop that character. It's Max von Sydow.
That's right. And I don't think he was doing journal entries like, I don't understand this rubbish. Why are they doing this? Why am I doing it?
Oh, poor Alec.
His check cleared. He's okay. Conan the Barbarian. So as I said, you have a Conan poster in your house. Please, your love of Conan the Barbarian.
It's a way better film than anybody ever probably expected it to be. I mean, John Milius is insane. Everyone knows
that. Yes,
it's this bizarre epic with a weird provenance. I mean, Oliver Stone co-wrote the screenplay for this sword and sorcery epic in 1982.
There was a glut of sword and sandal films.
There was. In fact, it spawned probably just as many imitators as Star Wars in its own genre, although a lot cheaper, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Von Sydow, even then, was playing the sort of aged king character.
That's right, he was.
And in fact, in interviews, because yes, I've watched all the interviews on the DVD as well. Vincito actually he talks about a scene that was cut from the final film, actually, in which members of James Earl Jones's snake cult actually murdered.
I'm sorry. These are your pledge dollars at work, folks. How often do you get to hear those words in that order?
They will all drown in lakes of blood. there's a deleted scene where he was murdered with swords, and he just remembers that he had these like immense, ridiculous blood bags that he had to wear, and just blood exploding all over the place. And you know, the interview was conducted with him like sitting in his living room in the winter, and, like drinking tea and looking terribly charming. And
yes,
I just always remember that was a sort of interestingly gentlemanly way to remember this outrageous movie.
Way to go, King Osric. Okay, so I'm just asking a request. Would you please do your impression of the commentary track of Conan the Barbarian? He knows what I'm asking.
Yeah, actually, on the commentary track, God, I know. So, this was one of the first DVDs I ever bought, so I spent a lot of time with it.
No, that's fine. But I have yet to sit down and actually listen to the commentary
on
track.
On the commentary track. To Conan the Barbarian, John Milius and Arnold Schwarzenegger are just shooting the breeze.
There's
about
a
everything.
Brunch right there.
And, yeah, they start out like imitating each other. John Milius like doing his best Arnold voice, and Arnold just doing Arnold.
Yeah, not a strong impressionist. Frank Gorshin doesn't have anything to worry about.
Do you want to hear how I do a Russian accent? This is my Russian accent. It sounds very Russian, doesn't it? Or he could call me Ivan.
Didn't he have the thing where something would happen and he would just say, there's that. Like, I think the best line is, there's a cow on screen. Ooh, a cow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of how the commentary track went. So that's really cool. I need to revisit. And funny, you mentioned John Milius. I wish Vanity Fair had done the team photo of insane film directors.
He'd be
Ken
up there.
Russell,
yes.
Lars von Trier, I think definitely on that.
You'd have to get them all in the same room together.
That's a problem. Yeah, okay. Yeah, the other one I mentioned, he worked with John Huston twice. The other one is Victory. Victory is another. I'll get to another Conan thing in a moment. But here's your cast. It's basically a soccer match at a POW camp, and it's like the Longest Yard meets any, you know, Hogan's Heroes. I didn't want to say Schindler's List, but you have
Stalag 17.
There you go. Yeah, Stalag 17 meets the Longest Yard, and you have Sylvester Stallone, who was the star at the time. This is a year after Rocky II, playing a Canadian goalie. Your coach is Michael Caine. You have Max von Sydow as a German officer who loves soccer, football, and making his movie debut, because you asked for it, Pele.
Wow. All
and
right.
I believe
that almost beats Pat Boone in
Greatest Story Ever Told.
Greatest,
yeah.
Story Ever Told.
And there's, I believe, a moment where, like, when the POWs score a goal, that von Sydow accidentally claps because it was done so well. I think it might have been, I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but I believe it was like Pele's famous bend it, windmill kind of kick.
Oh,
so
the bicycle kick? Was that
it might have been the bicycle kick. So if you want to blame.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've now heard the extent of my knowledge of soccer.
So I think if you want to see the origins of the crowd turning in Rocky IV, you could start with Max von Sydow and Victory. But that's, anyway, it's a fascinating film in itself. Conan the Destroyer also has this random, let's just throw all these people together, Arnold, Grace Jones, Wilt Chamberlain, and Mako. That's a brunch. I want to see that brunch as well.
I'm sure there were several. although I'm not sure, you know, how much food was actually consumed, that said, in it.
The other thing I watched, in 1983 alone, he was a Blofeld, even if it was the one James Bond film that's not associated with the broccoli.
That was like a non-canon Bond film.
Yeah, Never Say Never. Played Blofeld, Never Say Never Again.
Not produced by Cubby Broccoli.
No. But was that year the best Bond film? Because it was up against Octopussy.
Yeah, well, That's like arm wrestling a third grader.
I know. So he was in that. Oh God, he was uncredited in the Ice Pirates. That makes me think about the Ice Pirates when you tried to make Robert Urich a movie star. But so here's the other thing. So I had friends that went to the University of Michigan, and Max spoke there. He was a guest lecturer, and it was after he got nominated for Pele the Conqueror, not Pele, Pele the Conqueror. And he's introduced, of course, by, you know, he's worked with Ingmar Bergman and worked with Woody Allen and John Huston. And he goes to the podium, and I believe it was my friends in the back row who screamed Ming the Merciless and Brewmeister Smith. And according to these guys, he just kind of put his hand up and just kind of waved the gentleman, my friends, away, like, tut tut. But yeah, you don't get to see a whole lot of comedy from Max von Sydow, but he does actually do a nice job. And I own it on Blu-ray of Strange Brew.
Well played, sir. Yes. Perhaps the most unlikely Hamlet adaptation you'll ever see.
I say, how's that Hamlet adaptation for you?
Strangely, one that I didn't get around to in the stack of the adaptations.
I own it on Blu-ray. I remember, God, there was a very warm day in 1983. I saw three films in one day. I do remember that. I got dropped off at the multiplex to watch Strange Brew and Lou Ferrigno's Hercules.
God, I used to be on TV all the time. I loved it when I was a kid, though.
And then that night, my father took me to Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Well, that's an interesting little trifecta there.
And because of that, you're a pledge dollars at work right here.
There we are.
All that useless knowledge now put in podcast form.
Strangely enough, yeah, all three movies that I've seen, just not on the same day.
But yeah, in fact, so yeah, if you don't know, Strange Brew is Bob and Doug McKenzie, Dave Thomas and Rick Moranis, characters that they had established on SCTV, and they made a movie with a lot of elements about Hamlet. There's Elsinore Brewery and a brother
Mysterious
killing his
murder.
And little things like that.
And also a mouse in a beer.
And a mouse, yes. So, but the great moment
and the vocal talents of Mel Blanc.
And the first, yes. Oh, boy. Which just kind of pulls everything out. It's like the most non-Canadian thing of that is the dad who's played – the parents are played by Dave and Rick. But yeah, Yosemite Sam is apparently their father. So, but the opening scene – so Brewmeister Smith, played by Max von Sydow, has the thing of putting chemicals in the beer supply to just make people go insane. And thus the plot. So there's a little bit also of Three the Hard Way. Yes, I love Three the Hard Way. But the opening, his entrance, again, we never see Max do comedy. So I was really happy about this. But, you know, there's the obligatory villain big board and all, with the lights on where Elsinore beer is being distributed. And the minion for Brewmeister Smith kind of knocks on the wall, and we realize it's also a toilet. So the door opens, and there's Max zipping up and slicking back his hair. And also the moment when he, you know, comes up to the camera and says, "We will take over the world," and then leans over, turn the lights on, so we can see the lights. It's really fun work from Sydow, playing it absolutely straight. So
as you've got.
Yeah. I forget how did you see Dune?
Oh yeah.
How big of a role is Dr. Kynes? Because I saw that in the theater and I wasn't ready for it.
It's a pretty important role, both in the film and the book. And you know, that was the first version of it that I was exposed to at all. I read the book after seeing that adaptation.
Oh wow. Okay.
And then I read the book. I was like, oh, so this is everything that's missing. But yeah. What a waste of an enormously talented cast that movie was.
Yes.
Soon to be corrected. There's a Denis Villeneuve version coming soon.
Fingers crossed.
Whenever they reopen the theaters.
Yep. Yeah, played the older lover for Barbara Hershey in Woody Allen's Hannah and Her Sisters. I mentioned Pele the Conqueror in 1987, Billy August. That was his first Oscar nomination. Scoring through. Now we get to the 90s, which I said he becomes the elder statesman and, yeah, kind of show up. Awakenings, the remake of A Kiss Before Dying, Until the End of the World, plays the elder statesman in the Swedish film The Best Intentions, which I believe Bergman did the script for. Played Judge Fargo in Judge Dredd. Wow. Worked with Stallone twice.
I had not remembered that.
I saw that film, and it's also garbage. I should mention our regular, also regular guest, Abdul Kim Shabazz. His favorite Max von Sydow performance is, of course, the devil in Needful Things. So, yes, he's played Christ and Satan in a career. Nicely done. Played the vicar in Jerusalem. What Dreams May Come, where he's the tracker. Sleepless, that was well. Diving Bell and the Butterfly. Yes, he appeared in Rush Hour 3. So what? They asked him. Solomon Kane, Robin Hood is Sir Walter Loxley. This is the Ridley Scott, not fun Robin Hood. Robin Hood with Russell Crowe.
I'm looking at that very same IMDb list as you, I'm sure. I had forgotten that he actually does one of the voices in the popular video game Skyrim as well.
Pretty good. He probably got paid for that more than some of the films he worked on.
I wouldn't doubt it. And, of course, you know, more recently people know him for a brief appearance in Star Wars and also Game of Thrones.
His second nomination came as The Renter, and he's the best thing about the film, Extremely Loud, Incredibly Close. Marketing Guru and Branded, and yes, Laura Santeca, is that right? Am I saying that right?
I don't think his name is actually ever mentioned in the film.
You don't need to, it's him.
Because it's Max von Sydow.
That's right. So, we've been scrolling through Max von Sydow's IMDb here at Film Social. You're welcome, by the way. I have in my possession...
IMDb won't give you this charming commentary.
That might be the new tagline for this show.
It's like you're reading IMDb with friends.
Thank you. Kobe, I wish you were here to chop that up. We could use that. So I have in my possession, Criterion has this wonderful box set of the films of Ingmar Bergman. And I bought it over a year ago. And it was one of those things where, you know, life gets in the way, work, family, work on a show, work on two shows, work on three shows. And I was like, I haven't cracked this thing open yet. And it's 30 discs. So and it's curated, which means they picked it in a non-linear way. So there's ebbs and flows as to, you know, we have the early era, we have the relationship era. We have not gotten into the really dark, surreal. Well, we haven't got the persona yet. But it was a great excuse to kind of tap into that. I'm one of those I have to watch them in order. So I had to watch The Silence, which was a non-Max von Sydow, but I think it was Tuesday or was it Monday? No, my double feature, and I don't recommend this. I'm currently in rehearsal for a play called 26 Pebbles, which is about Sandy Hook. So I had rehearsal that night. I had rehearsal for a play about a school shooting. And what did I gear up for it? By watching a back-to-back The Virgin Spring and The Seventh Seal.
Yeah, that's
don't do that.
That's
a rough day.
It's not not the feel-good classic of 1957.
It is not. The Virgin Spring... which I think Max has a better performance in that compared to The Knight and The Seventh Seal. Seventh Seal is a more famous film.
That's the one that sort of blew the doors open on the international art film scene.
Right, and it was his first time working with Bergman. Mm-hmm. But The Virgin Spring is based on Max plays a rich landowner, and his daughter, while traveling to see relatives, comes across three hoodlums who rape and murder her. And the hoodlums wind up staying in the house of the rich landowner. If this sounds familiar, folks, this was later remade as Last House on the Left in the 1970s.
And then
Wes Craven.
Oh, Wes Craven.
Yeah,
oh.
not Sam. No, Sam
what
had...
What am I thinking of? Sam Peckinpah.
Straw Dogs.
Straw Dogs, okay.
One of the other great messed up, trapped in a house stories.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Similar... Not the same.
Not the same. And right. And by the way, don't watch those back to back either.
No, probably not.
I remember I saw the remake and I actually liked it because you had Tony Gold. There was a period where you and they still do him, where you had horror movies with real actors in them, not some half-dressed unknown who's just trying to break in the business. Tony Goldwyn, a.k.a. the villain from Ghost, among other things. He's that guy. Plays the dad and, you know, has some chops to it, and which is, you know, you're supposed to care for these people as opposed to what, just watching 90 minutes of cinematic carnage.
That's true.
And what?
Gosh, it's almost like putting Max von Sydow in a horror movie.
Well, there you go. And in this one, there's a great moment of him ripping out a tree. And flogging himself with the branches before he's going to seek revenge. And for 1960, it's pretty troubling to watch. I mean, there's no blood, but the action in of itself. When he breaks down and yells at God and is going to, you know, flog himself before extracting revenge. And when, spoiler alert, whatever, he gets it. But he finds the body of his daughter, and that's where he's going to build the church to atone for what he just did. So, yeah.
A King Lear-esque moment.
Kind of, yeah, very much so.
God, I wonder if he ever did any Shakespeare.
Bergman directed several Shakespeare plays. I don't know if Max did. So that would be kind of cool if he did. Yeah. We'll have to check on that.
I'd love to see his King Lear if he did one.
Oh boy.
The Seventh Seal is he hardly says anything in it. And I also happen to watch The Magician as well.
How is that? Because I haven't gotten to that one yet.
He plays a character who is literally a mute, or rather. Well, spoiler alert for a 70-year-old movie, 65-year-old movie. is not actually mute, but it's bizarre. It's a comedy in the way that like a Chekhov play is a comedy, and it's like you're not gonna bust a gut laughing at it, but
more behavioral,
ripping open the veneer of polite society kind of
there you go.
Kind of comedy. Yeah, and the magician. He plays sort of a traveling showman, snake oil salesman, charlatan type, who is oddly enough poses as a mute, but other people in the company do the hucksterism for him. But coming up against his nemesis, who also played his squire in Seventh Seal, Gunnar Bjornstrand,
yes.
Playing a doctor, a 19th century man of letters who wants to expose the whole thing as hokum and the cruel tricks that they end up playing on each other. It's very interesting, and also features von Sydow sort of doing an early prototype of his Ming the Merciless shtick, because he wears this sort of outrageous little beard.
I know. I saw pictures of that. He looks like Lawrence Harvey's evil twin.
Not far off.
No.
But he didn't have to say much, though, because he has one of the...
great face.
Looking at him, I mean, he was like 27 or 28 when they did... The Seventh Seal, and then he just looks, well, like he's no age at all. He's mm-hmm. one of those people who just, you know, he looks like he could be either very old or very young. He just looks like he was carved out of wood.
Not
and
bad.
Just came out of the womb that way.
Of course, Seventh Seal from 1957, Max's first film working with Bergman, where he plays a knight who has come back from battle and has lost faith and gets into a chess match with death, which he's able to... delay a couple times.
Literally cheats death until he doesn't.
And then, I watched. There's a group of guys that, if I'm not working on Thursdays, we get together and watch movies and have lunch. We wound up watching Seventh Seal, and before I had joined the group, they had watched Persona and hated it. So I guess they had put a,
I'm not
cerebral.
Sure I trust these guys.
No, they're okay, but. In this one, this is one where the chess with death, you know that aspect of it, whether you've seen the film or not. But the film is for me, and it's been broken down, I should say, by everybody. The fact that the knight questions his faith, and by the time we get to the end of the film, he's comfortable with what will be his end. And I think that's all you can do, because, Father Time and Death undefeated
True.
As we're
true.
Kind of figuring that.
Well, the thing I found, starkly, almost too on the nose relevant, is that most of the plot revolves around the plague.
Yeah, there's that
and
too.
Traveling through the devastated landscape of pestilence that is, 13th century Sweden.
Yep. And there are there's a wonderful scene of a street fair going on with street performers, and then the crucifixes show up and. It looks like a really harsh Sunday.
Yes, and again, you've seen the parodies. Probably more people at this point have seen the parodies of all the various iconic scenes in that than have actually seen the movie.
Right. One of the things I wrote down in my notes, if we can relate to others, then there is no fear of death. And the knight winds up getting a little quote-unquote family with these performers and a family with a newborn – well, not with a one-year-old child.
Yes.
And there's the great moment of probably the most noble thing this knight does is distract death by knocking over chess pieces so the family can get away.
Yes, exactly.
And
exactly.
It's a lovely moment.
Because he says he wants to cheat death long enough to do one meaningful thing, and he doesn't know what that is yet.
And we see it.
You could argue about what the meaningful thing actually is because there are several other key things that he does throughout the film. But certainly they family featuring the young and lovely Bibi Anderson as the mother and co-performer certainly qualifies. Also a noteworthy scene. It's terribly sophisticated and hard to pin down its position on religion, on theology, on anything. I mean, it's mid 20th century alienation par excellence. So if you're into Sartre or the like, you'll probably enjoy it.
And there's a witch who doesn't turn anybody into a newt.
And that's exactly what I was thinking of. In fact, the people all in a tizzy over the plague, decide that it's all the fault of this young woman, one young woman whom they say has consorted with Satan, which, oddly enough, she doesn't exactly deny either.
No, but he were you hanging out with the girls in the crucible? Max's character is the knight, says, I want to talk to him because he'll know God more than anybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and as we were watching that sequence, I did turn to the guys and go, but does she weigh the same as a duck? Because if she does, she's made of wood, and therefore.
Again, those Monty Python boys.
They know their stuff.
It's like they knew what they were talking about. It's like they were educated at Oxford or Cambridge or something.
So, yeah, it was. In a weird way, I wouldn't say enjoyable to watch, but, weirdly timely and still really effective.
It seemed like the right thing to be watching this week in a strange sense.
Yep.
Seeing people struggling with seemingly indefatigable mortality.
So, and shopping. Lots of shopping. As I mentioned before, he worked with Bergman 11 times, and going through the collection, I've seen these films before. Like, it's been years since I've seen The Magician. I've not gotten to it yet. But because of the collection, since I bought the collection, I've been able to watch Wild Strawberries, Virgin Spring, Seventh Seal, Through a Glass Darkly, Winter Light, Hour of the Wolf, which is also a really good one, Shame, and The Passion of Anna. And especially those late 60s stuff where he's teamed up with Lee Volman. Really, really good stuff. So I still have to get through Brink of Life, Rabies, and The Magician. And I'll be caught up with Max's work with Ingmar Bergman, thanks to Criterion, even though I bought it.
It's one of those things like having the complete works of Shakespeare on your shelf. I mean, how often are you going to pop it open and watch King John?
Or read King John? That is true. That's why
it's even harder to watch King John. Cause...
or Pericles.
That's what we call a callback, folks.
I was in a production of a play called The Book of Will, which was done at Earlham College last week. And Brian,
a fine production
thank you.
Of a very witty script.
And one of the running jokes is it is a story of two writers, two actors who are trying to make the first folio complete works of William Shakespeare. So I guess I tell when we were doing ad campaigns for it, we were like, think of this as it's not Shakespeare in love, it's Shakespeare in publishing. And one of the running bits is one of the guys is obsessed with Pericles.
Yes.
And it was fun to hear the audience still laugh at the Pericles stuff. In fact, my character, who plays a rival publisher of illegal bootleg Shakespeare scripts, who makes a deal with these young lads to collaborate. And one of the characters says to me, "Have you ever seen any of his plays?" First off, I'm blind, and I said, "Yeah, Pericles, I believe." Didn't really move me. So, welcome to Inside Joke Theater here at Film Sociology. But we've been doing this for over a decade.
Hello, Shakespeare nerds.
Yeah. So, the other one I got to watch because it's out on Blu-ray, courtesy of Film Movement Classics. But the film that he was nominated for Best Actor for, Pele the Conqueror, from directed by Billy August, where he plays an old widower with a young son trying to find work, migrating from Sweden to Denmark. And as I was writing in my note, Scandinavian Dickens. So works at a giant farm where he's ostracized for being older and not from Denmark. And the son has there were no light, sunny hearted schools growing up in this particular part of the world. So, but he had that, yeah, as we mentioned earlier, stone face, real gravitas, and having that kind of powerful guy that we've watched in movies for years be kind of a rambling, shumbling, at times drinks too much and is trying to get ahead with his son and trying to have some form of dignity while working in a stable. And it's a really nice performance.
It highlights one thing about Fonsito is that even though he has this craggy, imposing appearance and has this larger-than-life quality, I mean, he's literally 6'4" on top of all that.
Wow.
But he does have a weirdly relatable face and demeanor. He is paradoxically at once both larger than life and totally relatable, which is probably why Bergman would cast him as an everyman type character in such things as Virgin Spring and Seventh Seal.
And if you get a chance, and I was talking to the group of guys and Emma as well, there was a fun moment where watching this Bergman collection, if you had to twist my arm on what my favorite Bergman film, it might be Scenes from a Marriage. I love Scenes from a Marriage. It's Liv Ullmann and Erlen. I just had a brain freeze. Anyway, was made for Swedish television. Erlen Josephson, made for Swedish television. Basically, a marriage falling apart in a span of 5 hours or six episodes, and then there was it was sliced in half for a theatrical release. And
not entirely unlike the recent Marriage Story on
kind
Netflix.
Yeah, well, and there's a great film nerd moment that my daughter had that she caught before me, but it's a modern film, so okay, 1973, but the fact is this is not Playing Chess with Death, and it's not Persona. It's there's no symbolism. It is just raw of these two people trying to maintain somebody. I think it was I can't remember who said it, but there's a lot of close-ups of faces in Bergman's films because he captures inner turmoil like nobody else.
Yep.
And that's what Scenes from a Marriage is all about. And but I was watching I had never seen the full television version. I've seen the cinematic version, and it's enthralling. So I don't mind watching 5 hours of Scenes from a Marriage. I'm in the last 20 minutes of the film, and Emma came downstairs. And much to my daughter's credit, who she's 18, sat down, didn't say a word, and just watched it and was really interested. And so I wound up talking to her a little bit about it. Now, that was 1973, if I said it right. In 2002, Bergman's last film was called Sarah Band. Hi, Sarah Froelke. But it reunites those two actors, and it's basically a sequel. And what has happened in the 30 years since. And again, that day, the last 15 minutes of the film, here comes Emma. She came down and saw, and she goes, I recognize those faces. They're old now. And she sat down, watched the last 15 minutes of Sarah Band, and I wound up getting her the scripts as a present. So I would say start.
So now she's presumably familiar with the rest of the film.
Well, yeah. And well, we'll see. But we watched Marriage Story because Emma had not seen it yet. And that was my number two film from last year. And I didn't notice it. But there's a scene in their apartment because Adam Driver is a play director. Scarlett Johansson is an actress going through divorce. And as you see footage of their apartment, there is an article on the wall about them, and it's framed, and the article's called Scenes from a Marriage. And Emma pointed that out.
Well played, whoever directed Marriage Story. I don't know.
Noah Baumbach.
Noah Baumbach. And also, yeah. Well spotted, the Emma.
Yeah. And then as I watched it again, Lynn had not seen it, my lovely wife, so I wound up watching Marriage Story twice in the span of 3 days. We're fine.
The subtitle of this show is Movies You Probably Shouldn't Watch a Couple of Times in a Row.
Yeah. We'll get to the palate cleansing portion of the show in a moment. But as I was watching it with her, there's a moment earlier in the film where I see the words through a looking glass darkly. So I thought, okay, yeah, Baumbach likes Bergman.
He knows what he's about, that Noah.
Very much so. Okay, so there's all your information on so go find some Max von Sydow to watch. So Brian Hart's...
It's certainly not hard to find.
No, there's plenty out there. In lieu of today's the world we live in and what we're going through and the fact that right now it's going to be like staycation or, working from home, do you have any ideas of what you and Monica and Bibi will watch maybe over the weekend? What will you do to cleanse your palate or get away from the outside world?
Well, if we can manage to drag BB away, but who, by the way, is 5 and a half from her.
So you're not showing your virgin spring anytime soon.
Well, we're probably going to skip the Bergman for BB, even though there's a BB in several Bergman.
Nice,
BB Anderson.
Yeah,
but that's a whole other story. If we can drag her away from her current obsession with Frozen 2, which by the way actually is a very good movie. We have actually a whole stack of Disney movies, only some of which she's seen. I think we're up to 52 Disney movies now, so we'll probably try to get her to take a look at some of the ones, including maybe the classic 70s Robin Hood or
And by the way, these are physical copies, right?
Absolutely.
Seriously,
you can have my physical media when you pry it from my
cold dead hands. there's that. So.
No, yeah. Yeah, when the subscriptions for Disney Plus became available, part of me just scratched my head and I was like, I have half that on my shelf anyway. I don't know why I pay you $12 a month to see the stuff I can go grab from my shelf.
Yeah, I'm fine. So, cool. That's good. Fingers crossed there.
Yeah, I've also ever since Rutger Hauer. Speaking of other dead people we like, who have played craggy medieval knights, I've been trying to convince Bibi that she ought to watch Lady Hawk, but
I think that'd be a good place to start.
That's a good one for 5 and a half. Right?
Have you looked to see if Blind Fury is available on streaming?
That I haven't, but it may very well be worth it.
Now I'm going to do more inside theater because when we doing the Book of Will. My character is blind, but I have a great walking stick. And by the way, it was one of those moments as an actor. Once I had the walking stick, I was ready. I was raring to go. I was really ready to rock on stage. And Lynn said to me afterwards, my wife she was the director in the show. Take that for what it's worth. Insert your favorite punchline here. But when I insult the two young men that want to publish Shakespeare's plays, I have a moment where I jump in place and have my stick out as a defense and then kind of flip it around. And it's my blind swordsman moment.
Your Zatoichi.
It's my one Zatoichi moment. And Lynn said, I like what you did with the stick. I ripped it off from Zatoichi. And she's like, what? And so I had.
There's another Criterion movie. Box
I would
set.
Love that. And Zatoichi, which the Blind Swordsman, and it's kind of like the Django of Japan because there were so many offshoots and remakes and.
There were probably more Zatoichi films than there are Bond films at this point.
I would say that, and then Rutger Hauer kind of did an Americanized version in a film called Blind Fury in the late 80s. So that's what we're talking about. Yeah, Zatoichi would be a nice one to watch as well.
The period after he ran out of Fs to give and just decided to go bonkers with anything he could do.
Well, good luck on Lady Hawk.
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
I always use that film as an example of my Detroit sports existence because the Tigers won a World Series when I was 14. The Pistons won their first title when I was 19, and the Red Wings won their first Stanley Cup. Won a Stanley Cup when I was 27. So I'm very privileged in my younger sports days. The Lions, however, I feel like I'm wandering the earth like Lady Hawk.
Nice.
I will. the Super Bowl and the Lions are just never going to meet.
It is ordained.
Thank you.
Thus shall it never be. Sorry, man.
Not as sorry as I am.
I'm sitting here, and across from me, he is literally wearing a T-shirt that says Detroit versus everybody.
This was a gift from my lovely wife. She knows my taste. So
I'll play it then.
All right. Thank you, dear. All right. And thank you, dear. So, yeah, I would say find stuff to cleanse your palate, and don't watch the stuff that we watched this week, at least not in that succession and in a row.
Well, I mean, you absolutely should check out The Seventh Seal if you want something incredibly timely and also, you know, just impressively photographed, beautiful, weird arthouse classic.
The other – going back to what I was mentioning earlier, when it comes to – kind of Bergman 101, I have mentioned to Emma, I said, yeah, you could start with The Marriage Story or Scenes from a Marriage. Wild Strawberries is a little easier to take, and he's also in that. One of the best films about nostalgia that...
That one is one I have yet to get to.
It's lovely work. So anyway, here's if you're listening to this podcast, first off, thanks. But secondly, I want to do this for next week's show. Tell me over the week. I'm on Facebook and I'm on Twitter at Matthew Soucy. The show doesn't have a. That's another discussion for another time. But tell me what you watched over the weekend, to get away from what we've been going through and how we're handling things. What you know, we go to the movies for distraction. We go to the movies for escape. What are you watching over the weekend or between now and next week's show? We'll record on Friday. What are you going to watch for your escape?
Gather together on the couch at your house and fire up the DVD player or Blu-ray, 4K, or whatever streaming service you happen to prefer.
That's right.
And then tell the show.
There you go. Thank you, Brian.
Get in touch with Mr. Matthew Soucy.
It's on the wall. So, no, always a pleasure to have you here.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
And, we haven't quite gotten to Soylent Green yet, but the protein, have a protein bar. You'll enjoy that.
Yeah, we have food. Okay, yes.
Anyway, go see.
And that's our show.
Go see a good movie. We all need it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
And stay healthy.
Yeah.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!